Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Christian Swagel, who is the writer-director of the new film Sovereign. It debuted at Tribeca a couple days ago, and he got some nice plaudits there. People seem real into it. Stars Nick Offerman of Parks and Rec fame, Jacob Tremblay, Dennis Quaid. Real good cast here. And it's about the Sovereign Citizens Movement and a fairly disturbing crime committed by one father-son team of Sovereign Citizens. Before we get to the film itself, I want to ask what drew you to the subject. What was it about the Sovereign Citizens that made you, you know, want to give this crime the feature-length treatment?
Yeah, it's so I've long been interested in fringe ideologies, you know, conspiracy theories, cults, and how people are drawn to those movements. I also had someone in my personal life who, as part of a mental health issue, actually became drawn into this movement. And so I was fairly familiar with the lingo and you know, some of the just the weird aspects of it. And in trying to really understand that, I did some research and discovered this crime. And it just felt like a really fertile sort of ground to discuss a lot of themes that I'm interested in, a lot of themes that I think are relevant today. And I really respond to the father-son storyline at the center of it.
Yeah, there are kind of dueling father-son storylines. We'll talk about that in a second. But the let's talk about the crime itself, because this is, you know, again, it's kind of based on a real story here. What happened? What was the impetus for this whole screenplay?
Yeah, so the crime, it's the movie is based loosely, you know, inspired by a crime that took place in Arkansas in 2010. It was a shooting, a police shooting that took place in West Memphis, Arkansas. And this father and son, Jerry Kane and his son, his 15-year-old son, Joe Kane, were traveling the country in these, you know, matching white suits, almost like a pair of evangelical preachers, really traveling the country, giving these debt reduction seminars, which were these, you know, seminars that Jerry Kane had created based on his own sort of legal theories that had a lot of sovereign ideology embedded in it, you know, kind of straw man theory, if people are, you know, familiar with Sovereign Citizen Movement at all.
Well, let's actually stop there, because yeah. I think I want to try to explain to people what the Sovereign Citizen Movement is, because one of the great things about your movie here is that you introduce us to it by just kind of throwing us in and hearing this straight from him. I didn't know much about Sovereign Citizens outside of, like, they have weird ideas about who federal laws apply to and who they don't. And it was really interesting. So what is a sovereign citizen?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of kind of branches of sovereign citizens, but I would say what they are generally are people who feel that the federal government is a corporate fiction, that the concept of the federal government is really not constitutional, that the laws that the federal government tries to enforce through agencies are not constitutional, and that if you don't enter into contract with the government through this complex sort of series of opting outs that they train you in, you know, that sovereigns believe you can do, you're effectively not in contract with this corporate entity of the United States of America, and you are then a free person on the land. And you know, it's there is some sort of there's a basis to this. It's a misreading of a lot of constitutional law and case law, and you know, they're constantly they cite commercial codes and admiralty law, and each of these sovereign gurus who kind of spring up and have come up over the years have their own take on this usually. It's a little bit it's almost like a religious movement in a sense, in the way that like certain preachers will interpret the Bible a certain way and come to certain conclusions, but the text is the Bible in that case, or you know, whatever the text is. In this case, for sovereigns, the text is really the US Constitution and our set of laws. And you know, they have their own interpretations of these laws. And so these ideas kind of catch on and are really seductive to people. I've found they are having a tough time. You know, they've in a lot of cases, maybe they've lost their house due to some sort of you know, they signed a bad loan, or there's a balloon payment on a loan, or they fell behind in their payments, or they were denied coverage for something for their insurance that they thought they should have been covered for, or they filed their taxes wrong and now there's a bunch of penalties and there's a lien against them. You know, there was usually, in my experience and in my research, there was usually a very valid injury or grievance that drove people to seek out these ideas, but the answers that they arrived at were really misguided. And so that was kind of, you know, my interest in it though.
Yeah, I mean, what is fascinating when we watch the Nick Offerman character and his son Jacob Tremblay kind of travel the country, it is they are offering people a sort of get out of jail free card, a get out of debt free card, more or less. They're saying, hey, here's a way to get back on your feet again without having to, you know, actually pay the things that you owe, which is obviously very, that is a siren song for a lot of people. I can see why it would be appealing.
And I think even sort of beyond that, a lot of people that felt I think there are a lot of people that feel kind of preyed upon by the system. It's really about like a lack of trust in official systems. And I think when there's not a clear cut or compassionate sort of official response to those grievances, I think you get people like a Jerry Kane that steps forward with their own set of answers. And I think you know in the in the 15 years since this crime, I think we've seen that kind of proliferate and even grow exponentially.
What sort of research did you do for this? Were you out there interviewing members of the sovereign citizens? Were you just was it books? Were you journalism? What were you reading, and who are you talking to kind of inform your writing on this?
So there was a really a great deal of research done on this specific case, not just things like, so we had access to police reports. There were video recordings of Jerry's sermons. Yeah, we had catalogs of all his online radio shows. You know, so there was sort of the forensic and like evidence of the case that existed online in a lot of cases. But then there was also a lot of academic research that was done on this case from the standpoint of like case studies in extremism. I can't remember the exact universities, but there were like two pretty maybe they were like thesis projects or something for a PhD, but I was able to get access to those as well. And so there was a lot of just hard evidence on the internet and then evidence, academic evidence. And then, like I said, without getting sort of too much into detail, I had a family member who had mental health issues who became involved in this. And so I had a lot of one-on-one experience with them as well, into that thinking and sort of how mental health plays into this in cases. And I do believe it also played into it with the case of Jerry Kane. And then as the wheels sort of started turning on this project and we started actually filming and gearing up to film, there were more, I wouldn't call them sovereign citizens necessarily by definition. Today, they're more sort of QAnon adjacent, but there were a number of people that I spoke to who were certainly of that mindset. And yeah, like I said, I think the consistent theme across all of that was sort of a distrust in systems and in feeling sort of an injury that was unaddressed.
It's I mean, again, it's really interesting to watch this movie and to be kind of vaguely aware of what these folks are up to and then see it play out. And it must be hard as a writer and as a director to do this in a way that is both sympathetic because you want to have empathy for your characters. But also without making excuses, without, saying this is, without letting folks off the hook. How do you balance that when you're writing?
I think it's incredibly hard, and I think that's the hardest part of telling a story like this. I think it's going to continue to be a challenge, even with the film in a finished state. I think it will that sort of ambiguity there, or that line that we're walking, will be maybe unsatisfying for some people, for some viewers. I think that, but what I come back to is that it's a true story. It's something that happened. This crime was a tragedy. There's no condoning or excusing that it happened, but it did happen, and we sort of see things like this happen more and more. There are, I've heard by some estimates over 300,000 sovereign citizens in the United States. I don't know how many QAnon, or sort of if you expand that out into just sort of the more general anti-government conspiracy kind of mindset, I'm sure it's much more than that. And so it's a very real thing that's very prevalent in American culture right now, I think. And so I think if you're going to tell a story like that, you should try to be as objective about it as possible. And instead of just kind of flatly condemning, which I think is sort of the obvious thing to do, I think it's a my interest was more in trying to understand, more in kind of like, let's dig into the motivations rather than sort of moralizing. And I think that's sort of a starting point for trying to understand how to prevent something like this maybe from happening again, or from trying to, or trying to just understand where this is coming from. I don't think you can really understand where somebody's coming from if you start with a condemnation necessarily as the first step. It doesn't mean that it's not your final step, and certainly my feelings on this crime, and I would hope people watching the film obviously realize what a horrible thing this was, and there's no excusing it. But I do think there's a first step, which is to try to understand how did it start.
And the heart of the crime, the thing that makes it hard for me to watch as a father, is that it does involve a child who is who is not allowed to go to school, who is raised at home by his father, who has been kind of, kept away from his peers, whose home life is falling apart. How do you I are do you have kids? Is are
I
you
do. Yeah, I have two kids. I have a son and a daughter.
Same. And it's that is the hardest part of this movie for me to watch, is just watching this poor kid. When you're as a father, as you're writing it, how do you deal with that kind of emotion? How do you feed that emotion into it to really flesh out that poor kid's life?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's true about it, from my perspective at least, and what's difficult is that you're, when you're that age, when you're a kid and you're not exposed to a lot. I was an only child growing up, so I spent a lot of time with my parents. I spent a lot of time with my father, and regardless of sort of who they are in the world or what their beliefs are, right or wrong, you love them. They're your parent. You have a, if you're close and you have that relationship, you can, that bond is very, very strong. It's sort of foundational. And so I think what was interesting to me about this story is you have a young man who is, 15 years old, who is interested in exploring the outside world, who's interested in doing normal things like going to school or having a, he has kind of a crush on the girl next door, and how do you balance that with this really foundational love for a parent? And when exploring those other things is seen by that parent as kind of a betrayal in a way, for how they think you should go through the world. And so it was really as tough as those, as tough as this story is in many ways, I think the thing that's complicated about it is there is a genuine love between Jerry and Joe Kane in the movie. He kind of idolizes his son in a lot of ways. So I think I wrote it from the perspective of putting my shoes in Jacob Tremblay's position, and as a son, how would it feel to try to break away from somebody who you knew was you love them more than anything, but they're bad for you? And I think people can have probably can relate to that to some degree.
Yeah, we haven't discussed much. There's kind of a parallel storytelling in this between the sovereign citizen family, and then there's a family of cops. Dennis Quaid plays the father. The opening scene, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, involves Dennis Quaid kind of sitting in a cop car looking forlorn and distraught, which, some foreshadowing there. When you were trying to balance that story, and flesh out that part, to make it appeal to an actor like Dennis Quaid, who is obviously a big star. Like, how do you again, it's the same, it's the empathy question. How do you make the victims and the victims' families and the perpetrators and the perpetrators' families all kind of feel like they're on the same plane of suffering?
Well, I don't think that you can approach it from a macro sort of level like that. I think you just, at least my process was just trying to get into the mindset of each character and to just tell that story. I think if it, when you're telling a story that touches on a lot of themes and ideas and systemic failure or fatherhood or empathy and all these big themes that were sort of circling with just the text, I think you try to, if you address those two head on, it can sort of feel, the message becomes more the movie than the movie is the movie in a way. Like you're sort of lecturing at a certain point, and I don't think that's really like honest either. And so we tried to just keep it really rooted in the characters' experiences and in their relationships. And in some of those cases, it was really simple. I think the police storyline with Dennis is, I think really accurately sort of portrays like a lot of just everyday life. Most of the conversations you have with your son or your daughter or whoever, your spouse in the car, are just kind of about things. It's more just, there it that storyline was a lot of vignettes really just showing how they relate. And there wasn't kind of an end point to that, more as it was just a snapshot into their lives and a snapshot into the mindset, I think, of a lot of fathers that have that type of relationship with their son as well. So it was the contrast between those two storylines was really to try to highlight that there's a, I don't know, maybe you'd call it like a masculine drive I've found even as a dad, that you have this kind of masculine drive to teach your kid, to teach your son especially, like how to be in the world. And I do think that that best intentioned advice sometimes is kind of the worst advice. It can be, sometimes that is the way that sort of, I've heard somebody else say like generational trauma or something like that is passed down, some of these ideas. But without getting too academic about it, I mean, it was really just showing that like this is a, the way that these two fathers and sons relate is fairly similar, like despite the fact that they're kind of on opposite sides of the coin in a way.
The casting of Nick Offerman in this movie is great. First off, because Nick Offerman, just a very good actor, like he's wonderful. But it's also, there is kind of a metatextual idea here. You know, Nick Offerman, best known as Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec, who is kind of a government leave me alone type. And yeah. Obviously the sovereign citizen movement is the extreme version of that, the extreme, you know, kind of furthest out version of that. Was that intentional at all in the casting? How did he get involved with this project?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I was actually kind of primarily introduced to Nick through the Alex Garland series Devs. I like Parks and Rec, but I think I had the benefit of that not being sort of like the primary thing in my mind. I love him as a dramatic actor. And he's a brilliant actor. And, but certainly when we were casting, the Ron Swanson character was a layer that felt, it wasn't the reason for the casting, but it was something that felt like a really fascinating thing to sort of bring in as like a, like you said, like a meta texture of some, you know, some sort, because that character is satire and parody. And in this movie, he's playing the very real version of that. And so I thought maybe, you know, I think we all thought that added that, I guess you'd call it like his history, would bring an interesting texture to it. But first and foremost, I think it was really his physicality. If you look at the real Jerry Kane and Nick, I felt like he had the physicality to play that part. And the role also requires someone who can play paternal and loving in a very convincing way, but then also shift into something dangerous and physically imposing and menacing. And I think Nick has those two things. And that's a really rare quality, I think, to find in an actor also.
Yeah, he definitely has this... he definitely can go from kind of joyful to very dark very quickly. It's a great performance. Again, it's worth the price of admission for him alone. It's interesting to hear you say that you like Devs, because I feel like I'm one of the only people who's actually watched Devs. I love Devs. It was one of the best things that was on TV at that weird pandemic time. To come out. So that's, you know, that's nice to hear. And then of course, Jacob Tremblay is very good in this, and, you know, playing in, he's, I mean, like Jake Tremblay is started his career as a child actor. He's getting older. And this is like awkward teenage years. How was he on the set? Was this a comfortable transition into a more intense, more adults-ish kind of role? Because he's still a teenager, he's still a kid. It's hard.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jake is just so gifted. He has such a sort of impressive body of work already at such a young age. His process was really internal. I would have to say a lot of my work with Jake was just conversations, you know, trying to be as helpful as I could to give him insight into what I felt the character was going through in that moment. From the standpoint of having written it, he would, you know, he really didn't take much coaching. I didn't feel, especially this being my first film as a director, that I wanted to come in and try to give some brilliant piece of, you know, manipulative direction in some way to tease a performance out of these, you know, incredible actors. They really did it on their own. I mean, they deserve so much sort of respect for that. And so really I felt I could just be most viable by being like as kind of a road guide. You know, if I could just let them know, here's what I thought this text was saying. Here's where I thought their heads were at in this moment. And what was great is that, like with Jake, he would let me know if that felt true or not to him, you know. And actors are the first great actors I've found, at least in this process. You know, they have to become the character. You've written the character, you have an idea, but then they're the ones that actually step into the skin and become that person. And so they can tell you, this doesn't feel right. You know, this doesn't feel honest to me. And so I tried to stay really as open as I could to have those conversations and make adjustments based off of that. But for Jake, he was really dialed in, and I feel like it was just a more of a process with him of giving him space to get into into the mindset, and then just kind of let him do his thing. And sometimes it was repetition or exploration, but he was incredible to work with. I mean, I think he's immensely talented.
Undoubtedly. I mean, it's again, it's a hard part to play, and he really nails it. You mentioned this being your first feature film, and I always like to ask first-time feature directors, you know, what was the biggest surprise in terms of getting this movie made, just in general? I mean, obviously it's always a journey. But what was the biggest surprise for you as you were sitting down to actually get this thing done, either positive or negative? You know, what was a good surprise, bad surprise?
Well, it's a independent films are come together with a lot of stakeholders. You know, so I would say in the beginning and through the end of the process, you know, you have so many stakeholders in the process that I think until you build a body of work behind you, you either do something so small and so micro as your first film, I think, like it's maybe self-financed, or you just do it completely on your own, and then you have control there. And then I don't think you get full control again until you're a top guy and you've got that kind of cachet to sort of be able to control all of the variables. So for my first film and getting to work with a real cast and actors, and it was a, you know, a movie that had we put money together for it. It was trying to just navigate those stakeholders to the degree that you can to try to have the movie that you're trying to make actually be the movie that gets made. And that can be sometimes just because of logistics, you know. You don't have, you know, it can be because of creative differences, it can be because of some stakeholders having a different perspective than you, or you know, but it was that, I think that was surprising to me. It was like understanding that the director, you have your best intentions, but you're one piece of that. And then getting that through to the finish line is really a hard thing to do on your first film, and there's a lot that's out of your control. And then secondly, I would say just that I was surprised. You know, you can go into a film and have a lookbook and a script and feel like you've really got the thing in your head. But then as you're making the movie, you're making thousands of decisions, you know, just even tiny decisions along the way. And I think the sum of those decisions ultimately reveals your voice and your taste and your inclinations, and in ways that really surprise you sometimes. So you can kind of go in and say, well, I'm this type of filmmaker, here's how I see this. And then by the end of all those thousands of decisions, you realize, well, I'm actually not. I'm actually more this. And so that discovery was something kind of I wouldn't have expected, and I hadn't necessarily, it had never been framed to me in that way. So that was another sort of interesting thing.
Well, what was one thing that happened, you know, kind of on set or on location where you were like, I had envisioned this in my head this way, but we're going to do it differently. It's like this is not going to work. We're going to do it this way instead. How, what was one thing that happened there?
Well, I think seeing the performances for the first time was especially in the early parts of the film, the earlier part of the narrative. I think seeing Nick in that part and seeing him and Nick, him and Jacob react, you know, just interacting with each other. You know, as much as I had sort of anticipated seeing it, when you actually see it and you're there and you're filming it, you realize, oh, this is our film now. And there's a whole recalibration that happens, I think, at that point. And it's an incredible performance. It's just still different from how I kind of imagined it on the page. And I think there was a lot more humor in the earlier parts of the movie and in some of the stuff than I had even anticipated. Certainly, like, there's some stuff with Martha Plimpton and Nick that is kind of funny that I wouldn't have expected to be funny. And so tonally, you have this very dark subject matter, but now there's kind of humor injected in parts of it. And I think navigating that from a tone standpoint was really difficult at times, but also like really fascinating and really interesting. You know, like you realize, oh, this is kind of different in a way. And I remember talking to people even during the edit, like, you know, just finding the right score for that tone, you know, finding the right way to edit that tone and sort of navigate that. It was interesting.
When you're on set and you're watching Offerman, you know, play this part, it's a little funnier. Does that change how you shoot it? Do you try to get in closer for, you know, facial reactions? Like, how does that alter your kind of visual sense of the movie as you're kind of watching this play out?
It did alter it a bit, because I think the extremes of these characters. So we ultimately. The movie in all of its elements, I think, and I'm not sure if it's obvious or not, but it's very stripped down. It's kind of elemental. The storytelling is, the camera work is very simplistic. It's shot on sticks, locked off, or it's handheld. There's no camera movement. There's no dollies. The music, the instrumentation is all elemental. It's like five instruments and vocals. That's it. The edits are very deliberate. The staging was like very deliberate. The script, even in its construction, is short, and it's kind of like I don't know. I heard this great quote. I think it was like Rick Rubin or somebody was saying, like, sometimes when he's producing a record, it's about like adding layers and layers. And then sometimes when he's producing a record, it's about like distilling something down to like something very elemental. And I felt like for us, it was that process. It was about distilling this down. And I think that simplistic and kind of minimalist approach helped to counteract the extremes of the characters really in some ways, you know, like Nick playing some of that stuff. And, you know, there's a scene where he's screaming mendacity, or he's doing, you know, if that was covered in sort of more of a traditional cinematic language or with more flourishes, I think it would tip just fully into parody, or it would feel insincere, or it could feel comedic. So I think kind of taking a very like blunt and sterile approach to it helped us tonally keep those, even the performances, kind of grounded. So I would say that's maybe how we shifted a little bit.
Yeah. And it looks great. I watched it on a screener on my computer, but it is playing in theaters. I think it's in 54, 55 theaters, something like that around the country. So if you have a chance, go see it in theaters. That at the very least, as I always tell people, it'll keep you off your phone. You'll be actually watching the thing instead of, you know, flipping through your phone at home, watching it on VOD. But it is also going to be on VOD if you don't live near. If you don't live near one of the theaters that is playing it, just look for Sovereign on VOD. It should be there on Friday when this is live. I really would recommend folks check this out. This is a slice of American life that is real and worrisome, and is something I think we're all kind of contending with and trying to figure out how to navigate in a world where the internet makes everybody kind of easily connected, no matter how small or how niche your worldview is.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if you think there's anything folks should know about the movie, about Sovereign, about the performances, about the real world stuff. I mean, what should folks know that we did not discuss here today?
I think we covered most of it. I mean, I think, I'm, you know, really just excited for people to see it. I hope that I hope that people I hope that people sort of view it and with an open mind and sort of a thoughtfulness. And I hope that they find it engaging and moving, and really also check it out for the performances that I think Nick Offerman does an incredible job, and the rest of our cast. And hopefully it's thought-provoking and something people connect with.
Yeah, I mean, Offerman gives one of the performances of the year here. If I see five more performances better than his, it's going to be a very good year for acting and actors. But he is great. Well, Christian, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And the name of the movie again is Sovereign. Go check it out. It's on VOD. It's in theaters. Try to catch it in a theater if you can. It's always better that way. I am Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.